seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
All right, you're welcome along. It is the Ryan Line on a Tuesday because it's Masters Week. Shane Ryan, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Nathan. I'm ready. I'm ready for the Masters. I'm ready for the Ryan Line. I'm ready for everything.
Is there anyone who just doesn't like the Masters who's a golf fan who's like, oh, this thing ends up dominating half the year? It's just another tournament. It's the easiest major to win. Come on, get me to a
here we go
U.S.
again.
Open.
Yeah,
there must be people who, you know, like me last night tuned in and there was 5 hours of coverage from the range, and you're like, the schmaltz is just a bit too much because I just can't put up it anymore.
Well, you know, if you're a huge fan of the Valero Texas Open and a huge fan of the RBC Heritage at Hilton Head, this is like an annoying week you have to get through.
Where's the guys outside the top 70? Where's Austin's motherman?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I want to see, like, we're getting Michael Kim in both, but I want to see Michael Kim contending, okay? And for that, you need TPC San Antonio and a much weaker field. You need only one guy in the OWGR top 10. Come on.
Wow. Speaking of Michael Kim, dear listener, so update to our pool. So as you know, you have to pick all your winners for the season at the start of the year. But you get three subs that if one of your guys isn't playing, you can replace them. So I picked Keegan Bradley for last week. Keegan Bradley wasn't playing. So Michael Kim was amongst my subs. Michael Kim, who's done sweet F all year long, stuck him in there. And then on Friday night, I was like, oh, God damn it. I was like, nobody has anybody really contending. It's fine. I'm not going to lose a huge amount of points. It's okay. As he's on one under par and he's about to miss the cut. On Saturday morning, I'm like scrolling through him like, he must have withdrawn because I can't find his score anywhere. He played the final five holes on Friday night in 6 under par. And obviously then almost ends up winning the tournament or almost ends up getting to a playoff if he'd hold that chip shot on 18. And God bless Michael Kim. I've just extended my lead even further.
Nathan, you should try to make extra money by publicizing this and get golfers to pay you to maybe next year to put them in these slots, because it truly is incredible. Michael Kim came out of nowhere. He had that tweet after Friday. It was like, can I just go into my third round right now, please? He caught fire. It's the Murphy magic, man. The Murphy magic is real and it's scary.
I really enjoyed that tournament, not just because Michael Kim held my interest, but obviously it was blowing a wind on Sunday. That 18th is a great finishing hole.
It really is. It's like there's something cool. There's not many. There's something cool about a par five that's pretty much unreachable, right? And or at least in those conditions.
For anyone who didn't see it, and people probably looked at the field and maybe not the strongest, but you ended up with a par 3 16th, which has a bunker in the middle of the green.
Right.
Then you go to a drivable par four where they're driving the green with a 3 wood. Yeah. And then you go from there to a par five that was not only not reachable in two, barely reachable. Some of them were hitting 6 iron in with their third shot.
Right. The third shot's very difficult. Yeah. And it's funny with JJ on the drivable 17th, which is just like at Oakmont, where you're like, oh, this guy, there's something that combination I think is very potent. A drivable par 4 17th is a great hole. I think like almost every course should have it. It's so dramatic. And yeah, it was cool. I mean, even McIntyre making that eagle there, it was just like, oh my God, he was dead. He was completely dead in the water unless he made eagle and he pulls it off. It was just a cool ending. I was writing about it. Otherwise, I don't even know if I would have watched it, but I'm glad I did.
We have lots of Masters questions we will get to, and this is the start of Masters Week in Golf Weekly. Fionn and Gary and Dave will be here with the main podcast tomorrow, and then there's going to be a live watch-along on Sunday where they're going to be joined by the great Shane Ryan. He's going to betray me. Do we have a time for that yet, Brona? It's being TBC as usual. 2 p.m. Irish time to allow Shane to get out of bed. And just before the real stuff starts, on Sunday. So that's what's coming your way across Golf Weekly this week. Before we get to the Masters, Shane, we do have a couple of questions off of last week's news. Question for Shane. What's your feeling on Ludwig? Another Sunday blowout at the weekend. 26 and just the two wins on the PGA Tour. All feels a little bit below expectations.
Yeah, that's not par profit. And, you know, he spelled Ludwig's name with a W to add insult to injury. you know, yeah, look, he's got a problem. I mean, he's got a problem. We've said that. I said that after the players. It's a real problem. And he's got to fix it. It doesn't mean he's doomed or anything like that. But this is no longer like, oh, yeah, he just had a bad day or something. And, you know, he wasn't, what did he shoot, 69-70 on the weekend. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like he completely gagged it, but there is something. There is something going on where he is playing extremely well when he's not, you know, under the gun on the last day, and then he loses something. And so that's why, you know, people are like, oh, can he win the Masters? Like, I don't think so. I mean, there's nothing that shows me that he's ready to kind of figure this out yet. So it's hard to know what to say about this, except that everybody has to figure this out their own way. He's a very smart guy. He's a very cool guy. He's going to figure out something, but it's also just that the pressure is sort of intangible. Everybody reacts a different way. Like, again, we talked about this, but when he came in on Saturday at the Players' Championship, he said all the right things. He said, I am going to be nervous. It's the biggest day of my life. I'm not going to pretend not to be nervous. I'm just going to try to let it flow through me. And everybody was like, oh, this is just what you want to hear. This guy's got it. And then, he comes to Sunday and he's like topping the ball. You know, it was really, really bad. So you kind of throw your hands up. You don't know how it's going to go for any individual, but he does have a problem.
He has finished top five in his last three events, and after a really slow start to the season, there's no question there's a lot of good golf there, but he has, the back of what happened on Sunday, probably entered sort of commentator trope territory, which is now this is going to become a bigger question the longer it takes him to win. And obviously he has won on the PGA Tour, so it's not quite Tommy Fleetwood, but he now has a Sunday problem that no matter what he does, a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, even if he's leading at Augusta going into Sunday, this now is question number one on Saturday night's press conference of, you have put yourself in this position and not been able to seal the deal, and you're not really going to trust him until he gets the job done. And he has another problem that they touched on the World Feed commentary I was watching. The smiley face, no matter what's happening, which when he first started out was seen as this, oh, nothing fazes this guy. A real positive. Now, and I think it was on 17, he hit a brilliant shot in on 17 as well on that drivable par 4. He gave himself an eagle putt, which I think he missed. And he was sort of laughing on the 18th tee with Kevin Roy, his playing partner, afterwards. And the commentators were like, no, I don't like this. It's got to hurt. It needs to hurt. And this guy has a sort of relaxed exterior that when you're not winning and people have an expectation that you win is going to become a bit of a thing.
Yeah, but I try to resist that because the way someone looks on the outside has no bearing on what they're actually feeling or what they care about. So it is like there is that human reaction to be like, oh, look how casual he is. Doesn't he, you know, give a shit or whatever? And it's like, no, this is obviously he cares a lot and obviously it hurts him. It's just that he happens to be a pretty smiley guy and he always looks calm, you know, so people are going to misinterpret that. But I always kind of think that superficial analysis, you kind of have to be careful.
We touched on Tiger last week, but a question in, yay, nay to Jason Day for having the cojones on the Tiger situation. He went further than other players and the majority of the media in saying it's a little bit selfish of him to drive and put other people in harm's way.
I like how this is controversial. Yeah, of course that's fine to say that. It's 100% true, right? I mean, people should be saying that. It would be when I read the start of the question, I actually hadn't seen this quote from Day. I was like, oh man, what did Jason Day say that's controversial about Tiger? Like, did he say they should lock him up for a year? That would be controversial. To say that he's selfish for putting people in harm's way is 100% true. He's lucky nobody got hurt, or he'd be, you know, a world historic villain right now if he had killed a kid or something like that. So, yeah, yay for Jason Day. Y-A-E, not the Y-A-Y. Not like cheerleading Jason Day for saying that. But, yeah, absolutely, that is something you should say, and it's cool to see somebody just be honest like that.
He did give a great line after that where he spoke about him being a little bit selfish. He said, when you're the player that he was and how strong-willed he is, he thinks he can almost do anything. And that's probably why he's probably driving and a little bit under the influence. Like, I just have a... And of course, he wasn't drink driving. But that the idea of Tiger going, listen, if I'm not fully there, it doesn't really matter. I'm just so good at everything.
Tiger Woods. Yeah, Tiger Woods. I'll call the president. I'll call the president. Donald Trump. If I get in trouble, I'll just call Donnie and it'll be fine.
Not Per Profit asks another question. At what point do you think soaring ticket prices into the thousands for events like the Ryder Cup, World Cup, now Olympic events in LA, stop being about demand and start becoming a form of exclusion, effectively pricing out the very fans who built these sports in the first place? Do governing bodies and organizers have a moral obligation to keep major sporting events accessible, or is reality now that global sport is unapologetically catering to corporate clients and wealthy spectators? So what's the fix? Who acts and what do they change?
Well, we live in a world where at the highest levels, profit seeking is the only moral imperative. It's the only rule. So as long as you can sell those tickets, this is exactly what's going to happen. Yeah, it would be great if there were reasonable prices, if it wasn't just about making the most money that you can. But the people who get in positions of power are not the ones who believe that, right? The people who are in positions of power and make the decisions are people who got there because they're good at maximizing the amount of money they take in. So that's never going to change. Is there a moral obligation? I don't know. It almost doesn't matter, right? It would be a nice thing. But who decides if there's a moral obligation? God, right? If you believe in God, like there's none of us can say what they're doing is wrong. Oh, we can say what they're doing is wrong, but we're just kind of throwing our value system onto it, which I agree with you, but it is absolutely sort of irrelevant to the de facto discussion of what goes on. So I'm reading this question. Who acts? What do they change? The answer is nobody. They change nothing until people stop buying tickets at their prices, and then they change. But that hasn't happened. It is a form of exclusion. But it's the same everywhere, right? It's the same with, like, you know, Taylor Swift is going on tour, right? Or whatever. It's the same everywhere. They're going to get what they can get, and that's just how it goes. And cynical though it may be, Nathan.
Yeah, and there's so many different levels to this. So, you know, you go to a Six Nations rugby game in Dublin and you see very few children at it because the tickets are so expensive. Right. And more often than not, the more expensive the tickets are, the less children you're going to see there because people are going, well, are they going to fully appreciate it if I'm spending £200 on a ticket? And even a Taylor Swift, whose audience is largely, you know, children, isn't going, what she's appealing to is the parents who will spend the $300-$400 or €300-400 on the ticket and buy two and bring their daughter along. Like, the World Cup will be interesting to see how it turns out, because there's so many matches all at big stadiums and the pricing for an awful lot of the games is utterly obscene. Right. And a lot of the games are going to be between countries where there's not the wealth to come and travel in numbers. Now, look, when they got criticized initially, they put tickets on sale. It was at $60, $70, but it turned out there was like 50 tickets in each 80,000-seater venue at that sort of price. But if you end up with 10, 15,000 seats empty, again, does it matter? Are FIFA going, well, we still sold 10, 15,000 seats at the highest price, and that's better for us to keep that artificially inflated than selling another 10, 15,000 seats at $100 and letting real fans in. So I don't know. I don't know where it ends. Like, I think one of the things that's coming out around the World Cup is that there's probably pressure going to come from FIFA on Trump to get the big corporations in America to go and buy all of the really expensive tickets.
Sure, buy up all the tickets.
So that they make as much money as they had planned on making. But like, the Ryder Cup in Ireland is going to be interesting. I don't think official ticket pricing has come out as of yet. They did have that questionable question on the initial application of how much are you willing to spend.
I like that. Let's cut out the middleman. Let's auction every ticket off.
€18. It's going to sell out regardless. Like, the Ryder Cup is probably slightly different. Totally. But, you know, do they fully gouge and go, we got £750 a ticket in New York? Will you get £750 a ticket? I presume they'll end up in the sort of 350, 400 sort of, but again, for a day. Of course.
But again, though, it's Ireland. So it's not only do you have Irish people and British people and, in theory, some Europeans coming, but every American's going to want to come to Ireland to see it. I mean, you could, yeah, you could. There's no reason they can't charge the same exact price they charge in New York. As you were talking, one potential solution, like, it is sad that there's not as many kids. Could you tweak the child labor laws so that kids are making their own money and can afford to go to these games?
These scroungers have had it too good for too long. Parents bringing them the things for free.
You want to go to the game, get to the coal mine, put in an honest day's work, and maybe.
Listen, absolutely. And here, we touched on this at the Irish Open, that what made Rory winning at the K Club so special was that there were so many kids there who created the atmosphere, that there were thousands of them, and it was free in.
Yeah,
like, it makes a massive difference. But yeah, I think everyone is in agreement. There's no stopping, particularly because people are choosing to spend money on the experience now over having a nicer car or building an extension. It's, you know, I'll spend the money on going to the thing.
Right. Which is crazy to me. I'm like, I look at the Ryder Cup and I'm like, you'd have to be out of your mind to go to this thing if you weren't going for free. Even if you gave me a free ticket, I wouldn't go if I weren't covering it.
Journalists and broadcasters generally aren't the best people to ask about this, but I've obviously moved on in certain ways of my career. And turns out, tickets cost an awful lot of money.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But somebody's not paying for you to go to all of this stuff.
Right.
It's a right pain in the ass.
I'll go further. If you're not getting paid to go to it and you don't have an inside the ropes pass, to give me a ticket. So it's like to Bethpage, for instance, let's say I lived in Manhattan still, or in Brooklyn where I used to live, you get a free ticket to the Ryder Cup. Oh, okay. Now I got to get out there either on crowded, horrible public transport that takes forever. Or if I take my car, I probably pay a shit ton for parking because that part's not going to be free and it'll be far away from the course. Then I get there and there's four matches on the course and crowds like, you know, 100 deep or whatever, so I'm not gonna be able to see anything. Why would I ever want to do this with my day where I can sit at home and watch a really high level broadcast?
Brona, this is the clip, Brona. And remember, we're talking to a guy here in our Masters preview who just couldn't be bothered going to the Masters.
Yeah, why would I go to the Masters? They don't let you inside the ropes at the Masters. What is there for me? Why
would I go there? Do not mix.
No, I don't want to play Augusta. I don't want to do anything. Augusta, it's not that good a course. No, don't clip that, Brona.
There's the headline. I have a question for you. I was thinking about this, watching the drive, chip and putt on Sunday, and a lot of the green jackets were hanging around. And what sort of investigating golf journalists can do into who the green jackets are. Because one of the weird things of being at Augusta is these guys, they walk around as if they're sort of just glorified volunteers. They're doing all the odd jobs. Like, they all seem to have a role across the week. They're not just there, feet up, bottles of champagne. I'm sure there's a bit of that. But they all seem to be involved as if it's a regular golf club in organizing this competition. But I'm assuming all of these, and I'm saying guys quite a lot because it's guys, they're all fellas in their sort of 65, 70. Are they all billionaires?
Yeah, I think they're largely all very, very rich. But they all have to be on a committee. That is the true thing. Every member has to be on some kind of, like, you're on the merchandise committee, you're on the competitions committee, whatever the case is. But yes, they're all, it'd be interesting to see if there are any exceptions. I don't think so. Maybe, like, there's not even that many famous people. Very rich people.
The insight of, like, that one lazy guy who's like, don't see him all year, and literally turns up with his mates on Masters Week. He's at the bar. he's the Shane Ryan of the Green Jackets. Like, you barely see him Thursday, Friday, Saturday. He'll rock up the best seat on the back of 18 come Sunday.
He's always there. Yeah, that's how I would be.
That's how I would be.
Be like the only guy there making less than 12 figures or whatever. Yeah.
Question for Shane, and this is a question I think we've all wondered heading into this week with all of the previews and all of that. What scenario this weekend makes for a better Masters than last year?
Anything where Rory's not winning. I mean, that was worst case last year. So
he's just rolling out the hits.
I don't know what mood I'm in here, Nathan. I'm tired. I'm in a punchy mood. Now, look, last year was, at worst, the best major Sunday since 2019, Tiger at the Masters. At worst. could argue it was better than that, and then you'd have to go even further back. So what could make it better than that? There's no story that would be as emotional as that. There just, it doesn't exist. So you'd have to get just an unbelievable back nine drama, like something like Scotty, Rory, Bryson, and John Rahm are all going at it, and they're all within one or two shots of the lead. Every shot matters, wild swings, etc. So that would be fun. I think that in some ways would be... We don't need another last year, right? Last year it was special because it was so singular. We don't need another thing like that. So I think it's just, I don't know, having a duel toward the end. I put together a list for Digest. I think it went up last week, of the 25 best final rounds ever in the history of the Masters. And it's unbelievable that they're all on YouTube since like 1968 or something. That's really cool. So I could go back, I went back and watched pieces and clips of different ones. There were some real bangers. I mean, you know, 1986, we were both too young for it to remember it, but it was insane how exciting that was. And not just Nicklaus. I mean, Seve's whole drama. And then after Nicklaus was done, Greg Norman, you know, gagging it away on the 18th hole. It was just wild. And then you look at something like 98 with Marco Mira and Fred Couples. Those names aren't as big, but it was a really, really cool back nine. Jack Nicklaus that day in 98 was like 56, and he kind of made a run on the front nine. It was really crazy. And then O'Meara hits the walk-off. And then, you know, like the Sandy Lyle and there's just been so much. So there's a lot of classic things that could happen, and I don't think it has to be as good as last year, because it probably won't be.
Yeah, there's nothing right now. There's nothing you could see that would be as emotionally engaging as what happened 12 months ago. But that's not to say Jordan Spieth doesn't chip in for eagle on 18 and suddenly win the Masters, and we're like, holy Jesus, that was great.
Yeah. Maybe like Spieth being in the mix is probably as close as you could get, right? Like him having a chance to win gets you kind of close to that emotional. Doesn't get you quite there, but it gets you close.
A spikiness would be good. Like, again, a Rory Bryson style, or just something happening that there's an edge to Sunday.
Rahm and Rory, considering all the drama on the DP World Tour, it would be pretty great. And I'd be, the troll in me would be tempted to root for Rahm in that case, just because it's so funny how it's all played out after the Ryder Cup, where it's like everybody was his best friend until the moment it was over. Then they're like, oh, paid to be on the DP World Tour, John. Like, absolutely thrown under the bus the minute it was over. So that would be cool.
I feel a bit sad. Do you not feel a bit sad that John Rahm is the bad guy now?
Yeah, and I mean, he deserves it to some extent, but to another extent, it's like to be embraced by people who are clearly just using you, and then to be dumped.
Even if you're, you even can't if you're say in they the were wrong. Using him. They allowed him. Allowed him a way back in on the assumption that when a path was created, he would walk down that path, and they created a path to let him back in full time, and he said no.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, you're ultimately right. I just think the tone, especially Rory, it's mostly Rory, the tone of him going like, well, now's his chance to prove he would pay to be on the Ryder Cup, all that stuff.
That's a great line.
It's just
It's a great line.
It's a great line, but it's hilarious how quickly he was ready to just kind of go after him in the press once Bethpage was over. A few months earlier, he's never saying that, right? So, yeah, I mean, like, Rory and Rahm would be chippy and awesome. Bryson and anybody. I mean, look, Bryson is a little bit like the Rafa Nadal of where with Rafa, it was like when he's in a final, it's going to be epic pretty much. When Bryson's, I guess last year might be the exception, but the tournament turned out great. When Bryson's in the mix, it tends to be an insane final round and a fun one. Other than, I guess, his first U.S. Open victory, which was kind of weird. But you think of Pinehurst, you think of the Masters last year. There's just a lot there.
Mark L. With the humble brag. Any tips on the best spots on the course to watch the Masters?
You can't go wrong just being at Amen Corner on competition day. And then other than that, it's like, you know, the sixth hole is kind of neat, like the downhill par three. There's various places that you can see cool shots. But if you can get in those stands behind 12, I think that is, it has to be the best spot. I mean, you can watch everybody go through. And if you have a good seat, you're not going to have to worry about people in front of you because they're tiered and all that. So that would be my obvious answer. I don't know. Other than that, I mean, you truly can't go wrong. I mean, assuming you're there on like a Thursday or a Friday especially, I would think the best thing to do And I wouldn't say this with every tournament, but I would think the best thing to do at the Masters is really to pick a spot. Maybe one spot for the morning wave, one spot for the afternoon wave, if you're going to be there all day, rather than following a group around, because that's significantly harder. So yeah, maybe it's Amen Corner, then you go up to the 16 on the par three, or whatever the case, but there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, I think it depends on how many days you're there for. If you're there for more than one day, I would absolutely recommend the sitting on Amen Corner, sitting behind the 12th, and spend as much time there as you possibly can. You're going to be in as happy a place as you will ever be in your life.
It's true. It's true. And you can always walk the course late in the day or early in the day. So you don't need to do that following a group, because you do want to walk the course, obviously.
And you'll walk the course in an hour. This isn't going around Port Rush, where it could take you half the day if you were to.
Oh, yeah.
You're Port literally Rush walking at the same pace as the players, essentially, because it just takes so long and all that. So, you enjoy. Listen, Mark, you enjoy yourself. We're all happy for you. Willibur is asking, traveling to my first Masters. The day itself, it'll be grand. I say it will be. Easy enough to know what to do and have a good time. Any tips for Augusta itself? Heard it's a shithole, but you might know a decent spot.
Yeah, the bar at the Comfort Inn on Washington Avenue. Augusta's it's rough around the course. So like a lot of cities, Durham, North Carolina is like this. Like a lot of American cities, there is your kind of historic downtown, which could be in, various states of either disrepair or it's been rebuilt and it's great. And then you have your sort of like highway area where all your car dealerships are, where all your chain restaurants, and that's different. That's outside the sort of city proper. That's Augusta, but around Augusta National is your, chains, your car dealerships, your kind of crummy part of the city that's just commercial and sort of run down. Downtown Augusta, I think, would be interesting for somebody from Ireland, because it is a city that's fallen on hard times. It's a little bit in disrepair, but there's a sort of character there, an old Southern character to downtown Augusta, decrepit as it may be, that I think is worth seeing and will give you a little bit of a vibe for what it's like. I'm trying to think of how I would make the comparison in Ireland. I'm trying to think of like a small. Ireland doesn't really have the same thing. The cities all seem much nicer than our rundown cities, but I don't know, the way that you would feel in Donegal or something. It just there's something cool about the area, but again, Donegal is much nicer, so it's not a good comparison.
You were going down a road there you really didn't want to go down.
I'm sure. Well, do you have bad cities in Ireland?
Of course, ones I've been to, it's not ones I would certainly talk about on air.
Oh, yeah, right. That's true. That's true.
We're a very small country. A very small country.
Okay, you know what? I'll just say it. You don't have to say it. No, it's a little bit like maybe being in downtown Belfast or something, where it's okay. But, or maybe it's like being on the, in West Belfast, where it's like, this is, holy shit, this is kind of scary, but the history is amazing. I don't know. I should shut up now, right?
Magic. JJ82 asks, hey lads, was watching Chris Goddard's press conference. He mentioned that his first Masters memory was watching Tiger in 2019. How depressing is that? Also, what's your first memory?
No, this is ridiculous. Come on, Chris Goddard's not that young.
This came up during the 5 hours of coverage saw last night.
He was born. Yeah, I'm not saying he didn't say it. I'm just saying it's a ridiculous answer. He was born in 1999. So he's 20. Saying his first memory was when he was 20 years old. That's crazy. Like, if that's the case, it's not a matter of him being young. It's a matter of him never watching the Masters when he was a kid. All right. Good question, Nathan. 98 is my first answer, but that's honestly a little late in the game for me, too. Let me look at the winners here and see if anything comes to mind. I mean, obviously 97 before 98. That's duh. But before 97.
I think I remember, and I remember in my head what may not be the reality of it, which was Miles Dungan used to present the Masters coverage on RTE, and there wasn't much sport on TV at all. And this just felt like something a million miles away. And I feel like it was Bernard Langer winning, because Langer used to play at the Irish Open all of the time, and it was just like Bernard Langer was like proper superstar.
So yeah, that was 93. I definitely remember Greg Norman's collapse. I definitely remember Ben Crenshaw winning with the Harvey Penick stuff, I think I don't have much of a memory of Olathabal or Langer. I do think I remember Fred Couples because my mom loved Fred Couples, like in a weird way. So I kind of have this memory of him winning the Masters and that being a thing. So I would say loosely 92, a slight memory with Ben Crenshaw at 95 is the first really solid one.
Smitchy asks, is the Masters on paper easier to win than a signature event? Only as the top 50 with oldies and amateurs, most analysis suggests only circa 10 players have the game or form to win at Augusta.
Yeah, this is a big thing that's been going around, and Kyle Porter had an interesting tweet on it, where if you look at strokes gained leading up, you know, throughout 2026, it's always like, I forget what the exact stat was, but you have to gain a certain amount, and 11 of the last 13 winners have fallen in this cutoff, which is usually, as you said, like 10 to 12, 10 to 13 players. And so he put the list for this year. It's exactly who you'd expect. You could argue that not only do you have fewer people, it'll be fewer people than a signature event again next year. So this little era we're in of 70 people is coming to an end, but yeah, you've got the oldies, the amateurs that aren't going to play, but it also just rewards experience. So that course also is going to knock out some rookies, like a Jacob Bridgman type, you would think, or even Jake Knapp, who I think has played there one time before. Those guys probably aren't going to win, even though their games are really good. Jake Knapp leads in strokes gained, on the PGA Tour this year. Bridgman second. Those guys probably aren't going to win. It's probably going to be someone who has more experience. So there's that element too. So if you are experienced and you are one of the top players in the world, yeah, it's like that Brooks Koepka thing where it's like the majors are easier to win. Well, that the Masters is that on steroids. So I would kind of agree with that, I think. If you told any player, it's actually easy to win the Masters, they'd be like,
That's the yes, statistically on paper, all of that. But if they decided, you know what, people love Augusta National so much, we're going to play the Tour Championship there every year as well. So we get a second bite of it.
Yeah.
Do you believe Rory McIlroy would have won a Tour Championship at Augusta over the last 10 years?
100%. Like three, maybe, right? I mean, yeah, he absolutely would have. It's not the course that was holding Rory back. He's obviously very good at Augusta. Yeah, so that's a fun counter-hypothetical. I like that.
Shane asks, who's the most likely to pull a Danny Willett and ruin it for everyone? Very harsh.
It's a good question.
You see, the one thing with that question is, it sort of goes back to your, and I don't know if 2016 featured in your top 25 Masters final rounds. It ended up with a scenario where you're going, oh, Danny Willett. And if you weren't a golf fan, people are like, who's Danny Willett? Even though Danny Willett was a bloody good golfer at the time. Was he top 20 in the world? Totally. Had, lots of wins on the European Tour. Doesn't count, obviously, because it wasn't in America. But, was doing all right for himself. But, 2016 was Spieth.
Yeah, it was a great final round. It was an unbelievably dramatic final round. Yeah, it was. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like it doesn't. The worst would be if Davis Riley runs away with it, right? If the whole thing is like, not only do you have a winner that kind of spoils it, but he's winning by 10. So that could happen. It's very doubtful. So I'm looking at it. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It seems harsh to say a Mav McNealy, but he's probably the combination of not a name you're necessarily dying to see, but also very good and could do it. So a guy like that.
Your worst case scenario isn't Mav McNealy. If Mav McNealy is is standing on the 16th and he's a shot behind John Rahm or Bryson DeChambeau or McIlroy or Scheffler and they stick it in the water and Mav McNealy wins. Your worst case scenario is Mav McNealy and Russell Henley are five shots clear standing on the 16th and it's between one of these two guys, and either way you're not that invested.
Yeah that's right. I don't know, Marco Penge, I don't know, that would be kind of fun too.
Yeah, I like Nico Echevarria. Nico Echevarria, yeah. Rasmus, who I got,
yeah, not Nikolai. Rasmus Neergaard Peterson.
Brian Harman becoming a two-time major winner,
wouldn't that be something? Yeah. That would be the Zach Johnson, two great courses. Hoylake's a good course. I don't know if it's a great course, but yeah, it'd be the almost Zach Johnson.
And to wrap it up, who is your winner?
Fitzpatrick.
Oof.
Gun to head, Fitzpatrick. Second, Cam Young.
Sorry. DeChambeau. Gun to head. If somebody literally had a gun to your head and you said Matt Fitzpatrick above Scotty Scheffler, well, maybe you deserve to be shot.
Scotty Scheffler's not going to win. Scotty Scheffler has no chance. Are we seriously talking about him still? I mean, this guy is yesterday's news. He's got a young kid. The kid's like 10 days old. That's crazy. That's, you're not going to win after. And he's just not, like, you know, he's been frustrated. He's just not himself right now. He'll win like the British or this year, or he'll win the PGA or something. I'm sorry, the Open. So no, it's not going to be Scotty. It's going to be Bryson, Cam Young, or Matt Fitzpatrick. Maybe Rom, but those are my guys. You?
I think it'll be Scotty, but if not, I think it'll be Xander Schauffele or John Rahm.
Okay.
I think Schauffele played well at the Masters last year when he had nothing really going on in his game. Obviously, he had a chance that year. He stuck it in the water in 16. So, yeah. And obviously knows how to win a major. Big name to miss the cut.
Ooh, good question. I'm going to go with... go with Justin Rose in a shocker. Justin Rose and maybe Tommy. It's going to be a bad year for the Englishman, except Matt Fitzpatrick. It's going to be Matt Fitzpatrick selling his soul to the English gods, and they punish the rest of the English golfers. That's how it works.
I'm going to go with Xander Schauffele.
Okay, love it. You got it all covered.
Cover all bases.
Who's going to finish 10th, Nathan?
I'm going to go maybe Bryson to miss the cut.
Okay, I like that. That's a good
player outside the top 50 to contend.
I don't even know who's outside the top 50 that's even in the tournament, honestly.
Well, I was doing inspired by yourself. I have my family doing a pool now that's very complicated. And cool. One of the things was you'd pick someone outside the top 50. But They all had a quick look and we're like, and I went for Brooks Koepka.
Oh, Gary Woodland. Gary Woodland's a great call.
Gary Woodland.
Woodland's a great call. Adam Scott's not a terrible call. Spieth, he's been playing okay. That's about it. I think those three guys are about as good as it gets, unless you think Wyndham Clark is going to do it, which I don't. Spieth, Woodland, and those are my two.
Spieth must be in the top 50, is he?
No, he's 61st.
What? Oh my God!
He's not played well lately.
Yeah, he's not played. I don't know if you've noticed the last 10 years, but things haven't gone so well for him.
Don't know where you've been.
Shit. I gotta go for Brooks.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, that's a great one.
And finally, it's quite niche. This one, best finish of someone who won pre 2010.
Like, so who won the Masters pre 2010?
So of all of the really owl guys, which is the one on, you know, on Thursday night, we're going to be going, he couldn't, could he?
Angel Cabrera's in the field, man. Your hero, Nathan. You're always texting me how much you like Cabrera. You're always saying, this is my guy.
that happens a lot.
Pre-2010, there's like nobody. Like, the winners, there's literally no one.
You're going to go Angel Cabrera, aren't you?
Who would you pick over him? Nobody else is even playing.
I'm going to go Vijay Singh.
Zach? Vijay, yeah. Zach Johnson probably is the best bet, actually. There's nobody else. If you want to go pre-2015, then we can talk Adam Scott. I'll go Zach Johnson. I don't want to support Angel.
All right. There we have it. That is us done with the Ryan line. Your master is Ryan line. Shane's going to be back on Sunday, 2 o'clock for the watch along. The lads will be here tomorrow as well. There's going to be loads more coverage across Off the Ball during the week as well, I am sure. But Shane, enjoy your Masters.
You too, Nathan. Have a good one.
Starter kid right here.